We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's get started with local and Occupy Seattle.
Yeah, I went down and visited Occupy Seattle for about half an hour last night just to kind of see how things were going.
No, slow down. I went down and visited Occupy Seattle last night for about a half an hour just to see how things were going. Okay.
And then, it was interesting. It seemed to be fueled a lot on hefty bags and blankets and umbrellas because of course
to be interested. It was interesting. It seemed to be fueled a lot. Oh, never mind.
Okay, so
you're supposed to be yelling now.
Because they lost their tents.
Yes.
This week, first Mayor McGinn expressed sympathy with the message of the protesters, but then he told them, okay, you guys, you can't pitch tents in Westlake, which I found kind of curious because, you know, there are a lot of companies, for example, that come and pitch very, very large tents. And,
like a carousel?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, and then the carousel takes up a good one half of the park for over a month. Every year. So I found it kind of interesting that he would force the protesters to not have tents when they're spending the night there. And then of course, after saying on Tuesday, you got to have your tents down by the end of the day or the police will come and remove them, and then not following through, it was Wednesday when the crackdown occurred. When the group had swelled, its numbers had swelled quite a bit. The police swept in. 25 people were arrested. 8 of them, I think, have been charged. Although the others could be charged later.
Yeah, although I will bet those charges will be dropped.
Yeah, because I don't see how the city could win a case.
Number one, they can't win a case, and number two, it's bad PR
at
this point.
Yeah. And then, of course, then after acting as the bad guy, then Mayor McGinn offered City Hall as a place where people could go and pitch their tents. But, of course, the protesters are not going to go to City Hall because going down to City Hall means they would be completely invisible. Westlake is the city's living room, and that's where they need to be for their protests to be effective.
And more to the point, it's not so much government they're protesting, it's the economic system, and the economic system and the retail system, you know. Westlake is at the heart of that.
Westlake is at the heart.
And the City Hall, as you say, it's invisible. It's a long way off. There's no traffic there at night.
Yes.
And they wouldn't be accomplishing their purpose, which, of course, was part of McGinn's reasoning.
Yeah. And then Mayor McGinn told them that, you can have one tent. You can have a food and first aid tent, and which they do have. But when I was down there, I saw a lot of people laying on the ground. Folks who are, you know, like I said, sleeping on plastic bags or who are camping out on blankets. Not everyone had a sleeping bag. So, you know, there are questions of, he's really trying to subject these people to hardship so that they will go away. Pretty clear. That was pretty clear to me.
Newsflash. They're not.
They're not going away. Yeah. And so, you know, I think we'd be surprised to see how well some of them are adapting. A company came in and donated some jackets that can be converted into sleeping bags and tents. So there's a number of people who have those and more of those are available for purchase. And then there are people who have been able to scrounge up sleeping bags and, like I said, are camping out under umbrellas and plastic sheeting and that kind of stuff. But there's going to be a demonstration later today, right, Job?
Yeah. There's things going on continuously down there. But today there will be a march that was scheduled for noon. It's been moved to 5 o'clock because there's an Indigenous rights rally pegged around Columbus Day on Monday. It's happening from noon to 5 at Westlake. So, this is what Westlake is. It's, you know, it's the gathering place for people around the city. And there's a march at 5. There's going to be banner hangings on the I-5 overpasses throughout the afternoon. And you can check for the updates because with the General Assembly each evening, things pretty much change from day to day. It is a democratically run protest. And so if you're on Twitter, hashtag Occupy Seattle is where to get updates on that. And then the website, occupyseattle.org. And I was very pleased both with Occupy Seattle and with, with the Occupy Wall Street movement and a number of the, I mean, every major city around the United States and quite a few not major cities now have these occupations. And a lot of them are featuring the work of Gene Sharp, talking about specifically nonviolent revolution, how you make mass movements, what this kind of a movement is. And a lot of the media coverage of the Occupy Wall Street movement and locally the Occupy Seattle movement has been really kind of dismissive. It's been
well, and it hasn't caught up with not only the goals of the protesters or their message, but it hasn't caught up with the actual actions of the protesters either. You just talked about Gene Sharp and nonviolence. Well, I was tuning into the evening news last night, and a lot of what they showed, you know, King 5, I think it was, had video of people in Westlake Park, and underneath the video was this very large tag saying "War on Wall Street." And I was looking at that going, I'm sorry, but in no way can you classify the Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy Seattle really as a war.
Yes, this is what class warfare looks like. Well, we've seen for the last 30 years what class warfare looks like. We've just been on the losing end of it. But, you know, where I was going with that, you know, it's very reminiscent of the old Gandhi quote, actually, that, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they crack down on you, then you win. Well, we're somewhere between the laughing at you and cracking down on you stages of that right now. But it's very much the kind of a movement that isn't tied to specific, say, legislative goals or supporting a particular political party or candidate or, you know, it's not specific in that sense. And that's what's confusing this sort of, you know, a pundit class in this country and in this city, is that it's not, you know, it's not exercising power in a way that they understand or that they're used to. That what it's talking about is delegitimizing entire institutions, delegitimizing the institution of government by and for financial interests, delegitimizing the control that major transnational corporations have over our life, and delegitimizing the passivity with which citizens are expected to respond to all this. Mm-hmm. That's really the goal, and, you know, getting people to join in and express their solidarity and do things that help the movement. This is one of the goals of the movement, is to just grow the movement and say that, you know, we are the 99%. We are the majority of people who public policy and financial policy are not being made on behalf of in this country. And we're tired of it, and this is not going to hold. This is not going to stand. Now, what it looks like after it doesn't hold, doesn't stand, is still very much up for debate. But, first you have to, you know, before you can say, we need change, and we're not talking about an Obama slogan here where we change political parties. We're talking about a change in the fundamental principles by which decisions get made in our society. Before you have that change, you have to have a broad agreement that change is necessary. And that's what this is about.
All right. Anything else on that?
Well, we'll probably come back
we'll
to it
when
we talk
about
the national.
If not this morning, then next week, in the coming weeks. All right.
Yes,
sticking along similar lines, Seattle Police Department developments there.
Yeah, another lawsuit against the Seattle Police Department. Eric Rockner sued the SPD this week, alleging false arrest, malicious.
They're collecting them, aren't they?
What?
They're collecting lawsuits.
Lawsuits, yeah. Eric Rockner sued the SPD this week, alleging false arrest, malicious prosecution, and, quote, spoilation of video evidence. Now, Rockner is the person who sued, who was arrested by the SPD and then requested the video, the dash cam video of his arrest, and was told by the SPD that they didn't have it. And then his attorney filed to get a copy of the database. Well, he got a copy of the database and found that, yes, indeed, the dash cam video of Rockner's arrest does exist, and he is in the process of getting a copy of that. Rockner and his attorneys, they received the log of every dash cam video shot between July 2008 and August 2011. And now, as a public matter of public service, Rockner has posted the list online. And I'm going to give you the URL. It's www.seattlepolicevideo.com. And that's the searchable database of what video, what dash cam video exists of specific incidences. Now, he's putting it online so that people who have been arrested and believe that that they may have been roughed up by the police, or there may have been something suspicious about the way in which they were arrested, or don't believe that they were caught in the act of doing anything bad, can look at the database and find out if the video, the dash cam video of their arrest exists or not, and then can request it from the SPD. Previously, you could ask, does it exist? And the SPD, according to Rockner and some other folks, the SPD would say, oh, no, we don't know, or we don't have it, or it's no longer there, or whatever.
And for a court case, when mm-hmm. you have discovery, the SPD is legally required to turn that over. So if it does exist, and there was a legal motion for it, and they said it didn't exist, that opens them up to damages as
it
well.
It does.
And it might reopen some cases.
Yeah. And that's another reason why Rockner posted the list online. So now that's two cases against the SPD over the dash cam video. And I should also point out that Rockner, after looking through that database, he also says now that the police didn't turn over all the video requested by the Department of Justice in their ongoing investigation of the SPD. That I found to be extremely interesting, that if the Department of Justice in their investigation looking into SPD violations, civil rights violations of people that they've arrested in Seattle, if the SPD didn't give them all the video they requested, that's going to be a major issue.
And that's the sort of thing that goes to the very top of the department. That's the sort of thing where, if that in fact is true, we should be calling for the head of the police chief.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's a legitimate question to raise otherwise, because this clearly is a pattern. We're looking at something that's a reflection of an entire culture within Seattle Police Department that is of a piece with the culture of people being roughed up, particularly suspects of color, that's of a piece with the public reactions to things like this, that's of a piece with the reactionary comments by Seattle Police Officers Guild, that are incessantly made. You know, all of this points to a police department that is out of control, that does not respect the people that it allegedly serves, and that operates by its own rules.
Yeah, and isn't following the law, when the public disclosure law says they have to turn over that information.
All right. Moving on, speaking of the Department of Justice, some local folks sending a letter.
Yeah, 16 different Seattle area community groups got together and they wrote a letter and sent it to the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division this week. Their complaint is that the FBI hires anti-Islamic trainers, extreme anti-Islamic trainers, to teach FBI agents about Islam.
And this actually was something we talked about a couple weeks ago when this story first broke about the anti-Islamic trainers at the FBI teaching elite counterterrorism agents about things like, you know, that Islam is a religion of violence, that Islam is all about jihad, and that every American Muslim is a terror suspect.
Yeah, and it really points to a pattern of bias in the FBI, that this training leads to an overemphasis on Islamic terrorism in their investigations, at the expense of things like domestic terrorism, for example, and that it leads to the stereotyping of Muslim and Muslim suspects. A lot of the complaint involves material that links Islam with Nazism, and as Jav said, it equates Islam with jihad. And that is what these groups are complaining about. Now, the FBI says that it's doing an internal review of its training and its training materials, but the groups are calling for an outside agency to step in and look at the training materials.
Yeah,
and I agree with that.
And part of this also is a question not just of the training materials, but of the consultants that they're hiring to bring in and teach these courses, because a lot of them are very well known and very published as having anti-Islamic views, and they're getting hired, and they're getting hired, you know, not in spite of these views, but because of them.
Yeah, so it's not like they're going down to the university and saying, who's the head of your Islamic studies department or anything. They're actively seeking out, you know, the FBI is actively seeking out people who are on the extreme right and very anti-Islam to teach these courses.
All right. And finally, locally, the city budget.
Yeah, I was looking at the city budget some this week. We've talked about it a little bit in the past, as Mayor McGinn made his announcements prior to releasing the budget about different things that he wanted to do, kind of preparing the public and preparing the city council for what they were going to get when he did release the budget. I did look through it a little bit, and I have to say one of the worst things in the budget is merging the housing department with the Office of Economic Development. It would mean firing the head of the housing department, which has a good 30 years of, experience in, housing issues, and then giving the control of all housing over to the head of the Office of Economic Development, who has zero experience in housing issues.
And not just zero experience in it, but those are all two fundamentally conflicting missions. You have the Office of Economic Development, which is all about creating jobs, and housing, which should be about preserving affordable housing, not developing new market rate housing,
yes,
but preserving affordable housing that you know doesn't cost $1,500 for a studio apartment.
Yeah, and so firing the longtime head of the housing department and letting go other senior personnel in that department would really only save the city around $300,000, and it would turn out to be a false economy. What I want to note too is that another what I think very bad aspect of McGinn's budget proposal is that he proposes to increase the rainy day fund by $1.8 million and the emergency subfund by $385,000. So he wants to set aside money, saving it for a rainy day. Well, I'm sorry, but the rainy day is now. And if you have the money, you really need to spend it. We talked about this a little bit last week, how nations in Europe who can afford to spend money to buy the products of nations that are in deep trouble should be doing that instead of imposing austerity measures that they don't need to impose on their own public and saving money. That's a false virtue kind of thing. If you have the money right now, you should be spending it. And it's not as if the city government is an individual who needs to save for retirement. City government serves a purpose in society, and that purpose is to gather money and spend it on services that are necessary to support the public good. And when you're setting money aside at a time when it needs to be spent, you're really not doing what city government should be doing. And I want to note, too, that the $385,000 that's going into the emergency subfund could be turned around and used to save the housing department, and it should be used for that. Now, the budget also, it continues some of the painful cuts of the prior 3 years with some additional cuts. For example, cuts to the Seattle Aquarium, to the Volunteer Park Conservatory, to community center hours, again, services that a lot of people rely on. Continuing cuts to library hours, particularly to library branches that are not, a lot of which are not open on the weekends anymore when most of the public would like to go to the library and use it, and cuts to book acquisitions at the library. It also, but in addition, it provides some increases for various city administrative departments that I found kind of curious. Some city administrative departments like ethics and elections, finance, the city auditor, the hearing examiner, the Office of Intergovernmental Relations, the Office of Sustainability and Environment, and the Office of Civil Rights, all of those offices get an increase in funding this year. And while you might say, okay, the Office of Civil Rights, the Office of Sustainability and Environment, those are good things. Sure, those are good things, but in a time when other necessary government services are suffering cuts and cutbacks, is it right to give more money to anyone? I would argue that the answer to that is no.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's go.
Moving on to National and Occupy Wall Street.
Okay. Well, Jav gave his sermon on when we were talking about Occupy Seattle, so I'll talk a little bit about Occupy Wall Street. This week, a notable change is that organized labor stepped in. Certain organized labor groups stepped in and stepped up and said, okay, we support the Occupy Wall Street.
And some didn't.
And some didn't. The more conservative unions, like the Carpenters Union, for example, and other construction unions, didn't vote to support Occupy Wall Street. And I found that kind of interesting, considering that the recent economic downturn has hit the construction industry particularly hard, that there really is no excuse for the leaders of the construction unions to not step forward and say, yeah, we support the goals of the folks organizing Occupy Wall Street. Other unions, however, did step forward. AFL-CIO, for example, voted, their leadership voted unanimously to throw their support behind Occupy Wall Street. But this could lead to some conflicts, I think, in the future. As Jav mentioned, the folks who are taking part currently in up to now in Occupy Wall Street, those folks tend to be a lot of unemployed folks, young people in particular, who haven't got much of a stake in the way the system is currently being run and the way the system is working right now. They're folks who are having a hard time finding a job, who are having a hard time making ends meet.
And if they find a job, it's not one that has a livable wage.
Yeah, and a lot of them are only working part-time and not being able to pay rent and buy food on part-time minimum wage jobs. So when folks who have as their goal, as their ultimate goal, a critique of the system and changing the way the system works, maybe doing away with the old system and replacing it with something new, run into the labor movement, which has, you know, a constituency of folks who do have jobs, and those jobs pay fairly good wages and have decent benefits, and those folks are invested in the system and the way the system works, and their critique of the system may be in some way similar to the demonstrators who are in Occupy Wall Street. It's not, their goals may not be the same. They're not for a complete overthrow of the system. They're more for making some reforms, some changes that perhaps the demonstrators at Occupy Wall Street don't see as something that will help them. That could lead to some conflicts.
And this is very reminiscent of the WTO history also, for people who are around then, where occupied labor wanted a seat at the table. They wanted riders put in the World Trade Organization agreements, you know, the multilateral agreements that would protect workers, that would protect the environment, et cetera, as opposed to the people who were blockading downtown this back in 1999, who were saying, no, we want the entire institution abolished. It was a tension then, and we remember what happened. We remember whose actions were remembered from that. There was a huge labor march during WTO that nobody remembers anymore, because it was asking for reform. It wasn't asking for the whole thing, and people don't remember it as a result. And the same thing is going to happen here, where the goals of the occupiers are going to overwhelm calls for mere reform.
This is a long running tension, I think, in left activist circles. This tension between the haves and people who have something and people who have nothing.
Reform versus revolution is what it comes down to.
Exactly, and it's something we're probably going to see as things develop with Occupy Wall Street as well. It would be good if folks could get together and, instead of having the labor movement come in and say, okay, we will negotiate on your behalf, which has happened quite a bit in the past, to have them come in and say, how can we help you? You know, how can we help you do what you need to do in order to make enough change so that everyone gets their issues addressed?
A good philosophy for any organization or person. Mm-hmm. All right, moving on. Cantaloupe.
They're fruit. They're in Colorado, or they're grown in Colorado, and don't eat them. There's a listeria outbreak going on in cantaloupe grown in Colorado in the good old USA that has killed at least 21 people so far around the United States. This is the biggest food safety outbreak and the biggest number of deaths that have happened in at least a couple of decades in the United States, and it's directly attributable to the lack of funding for the Food Safety and Modernization Act that was passed by the Democratic-controlled Congress last year in 2010. And you may remember when this happened, because it was one of the few concrete accomplishments of the Obama-controlled Democratic Congress over the various protestations of the Republican minority in the Senate. Well, it turns out that most of the Most of the reforms that were part of that package have not been implemented because the Republicans in the House of Representatives have withheld funding from the Food and Drug Administration to enforce a lot of those food safety measures since then. And some of that might have helped prevent, certainly would have helped mend some of the shredded safety net features that have allowed this cantaloupe outbreak to take place. It really underscores once again that we are in a time when we have some radicals in control of the entire legislative apparatus of this country who don't believe in food safety, who don't believe in worker safety, who don't believe there should be any limits on what corporations can do, and that because they take a lot of their money from those corporations, and as a result, people are dying right now. And more are going to die because there are going to be more food. There are going to be more food safety outbreaks like this until
some kind of in the past.
Yeah,
yes.
but more and larger ones until we can get more regulation in place to ensure the safety of the food supply.
All right. Just a few minutes left. Moving on to international in Iraq.
Yeah, there was a meeting this week in Iraq of members of the Iraqi government, not just Prime Minister al-Maliki. He's been kind of running the show for a while, but also President Jalal Talabani, members of the Kurdish groups, also Maliki's chief rival, Ayad Alawi. They all sat down together this week to talk about whether or not they want American troops in the country after the end of the year, helping to train the Iraqi military. And what they decided is that, yes, they would accept a few thousand U.S. troops as trainers for the Iraqi military. However, they would not grant immunity to the U.S. troops under Iraqi law. And, of course, that's the main condition under which the Obama administration will allow U.S. troops to remain on Iraqi soil. So that's a big source. That's a big source of tension right now in U.S.
The default is on this. The U.S. has already agreed to leave at the end of the year, and the U.S. is now pressuring Iraq to try and stay or to keep some personnel in Iraq after the end of the year.
Yes, and that's what led to the meeting. The Iraqi government said, well, we can't just automatically, Maliki said, well, I can't just automatically allow this to happen. We have to sit down and talk about this. And so the various groups did sit down at the table and talk about it, and they decided, well, yes, American trainers can stay. However, it's not under the conditions that the Obama administration wants. So we'll see how this all plays out, if the Obama administration gets its way or if the Iraqi government gets its way. And right now I'm rooting for the Iraqi government.
Finally, Liberia.
Three women won the Nobel Peace Prize this week, and so far most of the media coverage has gone to the Yemeni woman who participated in Arab Spring and who has gotten a lot of the attention as a result. But the two other women who won, for anybody who saw the film Dance the Devil Back to Hell, these are the folks who were involved in the women-led movement that gave an end to the Liberian Civil War earlier last decade, particularly the first woman head of state in West Africa, Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, and
by no means secure in her post.
And has not been ever since then, really.
Yeah.
And the good old boy network there is both legal and extra legal is very much a threat to her. And then the grassroots activist Lehman Gabony, who again is under 40 years of age, who led the women led grassroots nonviolent movement that brought it into a civil war there. And very, very much reminiscent of the people power that has subsequently been so instrumental in Arab Spring, in Spain, in Chile, in Greece, and now in the United States. And it's really very inspiring that the Nobel Committee chose to recognize that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Events.
Well, as we've been talking about, there was an Indigenous Peoples rally from noon to 5 today at Westlake, not so much protesting Columbus Day, but celebrating the fact that people were here and that that culture and those traditions continue. Also, after 5 o'clock, there at 5 o'clock, there will be an Occupy Seattle March. And Occupy Seattle is an ongoing occupation with needs for donations and whatnot. You can find out more about that. Follow them on Twitter at hashtag Occupy Seattle or the website OccupySeattle.org. And nationally, you can find OccupyWallStreet.org. And for the different cities, if you're in another part of the country, OccupyTogether.org. Also, this coming week on Thursday, October the 13th at 7:30, economist Jeffrey Sachs will be in town. It's being sponsored by Town Hall, but it's not at Town Hall because there'll be more of an audience. So it's at the Daniels Recital Hall at 811 Fifth Avenue downtown. And $5 to see Jeffrey Sachs on Thursday evening.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org, and look out for it. In a couple of weeks, we are doing a print edition with endorsements for the upcoming election, Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Seattle information and all other kinds of good stuff. So look for that at a print free paper outlet near you. You remember paper. It's very old school. And if you want to go the pixel route, again, www.eatthestate.org.
And I just want to include real quickly an email from a listener giving heartfelt thanks for your coverage and support of getting the word out on September 24th about the Occupy Wall Street. And she says, this morning I can joyfully report from Iowa City. Iowa is successfully and safely occupied with apparent full community support. That's from Kate, and I'm assuming
excellent.
She's in
thank
Iowa,
you. And as Iowa City goes, so are many, many communities around the country. And again, OccupyTogether.org is a full list of those communities and information on where in that community you can meet up with people.
And the occupations are going round the clock, so anytime you want to go down to Westlake Mall here in Seattle and visit them, I would suggest you do so.
Yep, friendly people.